How was your Valentine's Day?
Oh, it was good. My husband surprised me with this really cool thing. And I have to give him props that he even found this. And it's called the Adventure Challenge. I'm curious if any of our listeners have found it because two of my friends, when I posted, were like, "We have that book." I'm curious, but it's so cute. I pulled it up, Steph, so I could show you. It
Oh.
has 50 different activities. So it's like outlined in chapters.
Okay.
And each chapter has like a different category, food related dates, dates for the summer. There's double dates in here. So the two friends, by the way, that wrote me and said, "Oh, I have that book." I was like, "Guess what we're gonna do? We're gonna do double date challenges." And then it has these pages with scratch cards. So you don't know what your adventure is until you scratch it off. And the deal is you have to do whatever it is.
Oh.
So it could be anything. And then it has a little space for a photo, a little space to write about the experience. It tells you like what to expect in terms of time and cost and what time of day you should do it.
Okay.
It's really cool and beautifully done. I'm excited to do it. I think it's going to be fun.
That's fun.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really cool.
Nice.
This company has all these different ones, family version, friends version. I'm sure there's individual versions, just if you want to do some stuff on your own. So anyway, I'll give them a shout out because I just think it's really well put together. So we're going to commit just about every week. We'll do something crazy and share about
I can't
it.
wait to see that.
Welcome to the Violacentric Podcast. We are two curious violists creating a safe place to have authentic and challenging conversations in the professional music world. I'm Liz.
And I'm Steph. Let's jump in the deep end.
On my job this weekend, I had an at-length conversation about dress code.
Ooh.
It was quite a discussion because the dress code is like two lines for men, and amazingly, over time, has gotten longer for women and not shorter. There are things that are in red, underlined, boldface, italicized about
What?
things that we're not allowed to wear. Some of the details are nothing can be low cut on the top, so no even hint of cleavage is allowed to show. Pants can't be tight around your bottom. No skinny leg pants, the classic current look that's tight fit all the way to the ankle. Of course, we have to wear stockings and things like that. But I guess there have been times in the dress code where people have taken it too sexy. So they've had to put in all these rules about the things that are too sexy. And then on the other side, there have been times where the musicians have been too frumpy. And so they have to specify that it needs to be dressy enough. And a girlfriend of mine was wearing a top that was a little low cut, could see like a little bit of what's going on up there.
I'm clutching my pearls right now.
We ended up getting into a conversation with a mutual friend about how she spent the evening kind of self-conscious about whether or not someone was going to call her out for having her shirt be too low cut, the disparity of the dress code itself. I think that's what really gets me the most is it's not necessarily what they're asking us to wear or not wear. It's that you're basically saying to men, "Here, just wear this thing." And for us, it's like, you can be this, but you can't be that. But you can try to be this, but then if you too much in this direction, then you need to go back in the other direction. There's something that feels very confined about that. And I really like these non-gendered identified dress codes that are coming out. We play in a couple orchestras that have done away with this idea that it has to be men and women. It's just here are four options you can choose from, and they're very specific and they're a little less rigid.
It is so ridiculous. And I'm trying to think of the right word here. It's like just reducing us to the physical representation of ourselves.
Yes.
I'm not sure which point to make first. I mean,
This idea that, especially when we get into the discussion of not dressing, quote unquote, too sexy, which really bothers me because the whole point is essentially our dress is going to affect someone else's experience.
yes.
It's somehow our responsibility that someone else on stage might be distracted or someone in the audience might be distracted in the quote unquote wrong way because of the way we're
Yeah.
dressed.
Yeah.
Crazy.
It's ridiculous. It's this age-old you know, women are the root of evil. Not to take this in a feminist bent, but we are both female identifying.
Yep.
And it's the age old thing. When women were assaulted in the 70s, they told us to stay off the streets.
Yeah.
They imposed curfews on us. It's our fault. Yep. We're out too late. We're choosing a lifestyle that's high risk. Yep. It's really maddening. And so now we're supposed to edit the way that we dress so that it's, you know, not too sexy because we don't want to distract people from the music, but also not too frumpy because we want people to be, you know, visually engaged with what we're
yes.
doing. Yes. Which is it? Which is it?
Yes.
Yeah. It makes me super duper fired
up. Yeah, me too.
When I think about this.
Yeah.
And I mean, honestly, people, do you want people to come to orchestra concerts? Does it matter why?
Right.
Does it matter? Right. If people are coming to watch the orchestra and enjoy the way that people look when they're performing, or if they're there for, if they just want to close their eyes and listen to the music.
Yeah.
We're visual people. I mean, you don't go to a rock concert and be like, oh, I'm too distracted by the way the singer looks. Oh no. What about the music? Are they not both valid ways of enjoying the performance?
Right. And I'm all for professional dress. Oh my gosh, to this point, in my experience in teaching youth this year, there's been a lot of shift in how teenagers who identify as female are choosing to dress. And there's a lot more freedom, I think, in the choices that they're making. And so you see like a bare midriff or a really short skirt. And my instinct, because of my upbringing, is to be like, maybe I need to have a talk about why they should dress a certain way. And then I have to sit there and I have to think, like, what is my motivation for encouraging this girl to cover up? My motivation is because I'm thinking about what boys are thinking about her as she's dressed.
Yeah.
That's not our responsibility for a man to think whatever he thinks whenever we're dressed. Like that, it's a difficult shift to make.
It is.
And to your point about danger, last night, someone was parked in my parking space. I live in a townhouse in a very, very busy part of the DC area. And we have reserved parking spaces and we have unreserved parking spaces. So the unreserved ones are spread out all over the development. And my husband gave me the reserved one because it's right in front of our house. And oftentimes I'm getting home late at night and I would rather not have to walk late at night by myself going into my house. So I show up last night and someone is in my parking space at 11:30 at night when I get home from rehearsal. And this has happened a couple times this year. And I'm irate.
Yes.
And it's not about having to walk somewhere. It's about the fear I feel knowing that I'm going to have to park somewhere far away and walk with all my stuff, including my very expensive and valuable instrument, in the middle of the night back to my house. And for the first time ever, I called and had this car towed. I've never done it before. I hate it. I hate thinking about it. But I'm like, look, this is my spot. And I've had a couple of my friends who identify as male talk about this recently to me, how they can't even begin to identify with that feeling of being outside by yourself, especially once it's dark, and feeling afraid, being hypervigilant mm-hmm. about what could happen, whether it's a realistic fear or not, depending on where you are. It's wild, like, how ingrained yeah. that is.
Yeah.
We've come a long way, but still. Mm-hmm. Then you look at dress codes like the one I had this weekend.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that is shifting.
I think so. It seems that way. And seems straightforward enough. You know, with our youth program, we just go with four options mm-hmm. that are not gender-based. They're just, you choose from these options, no matter how you identify. How are you doing?
I am exhausted. I am beat.
Me too.
I had the experience of playing ballet last week, and it was a long ballet. So it was Swan Lake, and that is notoriously a long song. We had doubles a couple days, so I really felt physically absolutely beat up, like someone had taken some kind of, I don't know, and beat me across the upper back. But I will say that my body bounced back, and by the end of the run, I was more comfortable. So I think it literally, it muscles coming back.
Totally.
Those muscles that we haven't used in that way.
Yep. I have a podcast to talk about.
Tell me.
Have you listened to the Trojan Horse Affair yet?
No.
It's so good.
Oh, what's it about?
So it's the serial producers, and there's a new journalist, and then Brian Reed, who did S-Town, for anybody who listened to S-Town, which was so good.
Yep.
He is co-producing this show. And Hamza Syed, who just graduated with a journalism degree, who's also a doctor over in England. And the Trojan Horse letter is basically this anonymous letter that was submitted essentially accusing educators of infiltrating schools and training children to be active participants in ISIS endeavors. And the podcast itself is an exploration as to how factual that actually was. And it's just really good. I don't want to talk too much about the intricacies of the story because I don't think I'm educated to make comments on them. But I do think it's a really important listen. I think it's great. It's just compelling to listen to. Easy to get sucked in.
Good.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll check that out.
That's that. How are you going to pivot that one?
I don't know. Speaking of conversations that you think are going to go one way and they go a different way. But that's not really what happened. Yeah, I don't know how to segue that one.
I'm going
to
give my segue queen a break on this one.
Thank you. Yeah.
So we'll just jump right in and say, wow, Laura Colgate's amazing.
Yes, she is. She's a beautiful player, first of all. But second of all, just so driven in her mission and what she feels like her calling is. It was really inspiring to talk to her about all of her activism. Yeah.
This is just such a great example of someone who really felt called to do the work that she didn't feel was being done by anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And then join forces with somebody else doing that work and create a really wonderful thing. Just a phenomenal resource going forward for anybody who wants inclusive programming for female and non-binary composers to be included. When, yeah, they're putting together their performances. It's just amazing. But it goes beyond that. I mean, that seems so simplified.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, we talk about that, obviously. We also talk about orchestras and the roles of the players in the orchestra. And that was a really interesting part for me to hear her kind of validate some of our own observations that we have had about the way that orchestras operate in performance and in rehearsal.
Yeah, she's a chamber musician through and through. Which, what a great thing to have a leader of your orchestra.
Yeah. Enjoy this conversation with Laura Colgate. Season 2 of the Viola Centric podcast is sponsored by the Arkrest, a wonderfully resonant shoulder pad solution for violinists and violists.
The Arkrest shoulder pad features a comfortable foam pad, allowing increased freedom of movement over traditional shoulder rests. You know, I had been playing with significant shoulder pain, and the Arkrest turned out to be just what I needed to create an ease of mobility, and now I play virtually pain-free.
Yes, and I switched because I was searching for a more vibrant sound. The Arkrest's pad provides for less dampening, freeing up resonance for a fuller sound. In fact, Liz and I are so in love with our Arkrests that we decided to compose a haiku in their honor. So, Liz, you want to go first?
I would love to. Delicate contact makes space for deep resonance. My viola sings.
It's lovely.
Thank you. I love that. How about yours?
Okay, mine is playing without pain, freeing my mind and body. Sound of resonance.
Love that. If you would like more information, you can visit thearkrest.com. That's thearkrest.com.
Hello all, Liz and Steph here. As you know, Liz and I choose our sponsors because we really and truly value authenticity. We can talk most easily about things that we love and use regularly, which is why Potter Violins is such a natural partnership.
Yes, Steph and I both have been taking our violas to Potter's for years because we know they're a shop that really knows about violas. Their luthiers are some of the best in the country, and I trust them completely with my wooden baby.
And not only that, but I'm actually bow shopping right now, which can be overwhelming. But I always go to Potter's first because I trust them to help me find the perfect one for my instrument and playing style.
Yep, both Steph and I found our violas there. Bottom line is that we both love the Potter's team, and we're thrilled to welcome them as a Season 2 sponsor. If you're interested in learning more about what they offer, you can find them at potterviolins.com and at potterviolins on Instagram.
Our guest today is violinist and arts advocate, Laura Colgate. Laura enjoys a versatile career as a chamber and orchestral musician, a soloist, an educator, curator, activist, and innovator. She is the concertmaster of the National Philharmonic here in D.C., where she's also the adjunct professor of entrepreneurship for arts leaders at the University of Maryland. Laura is the co-founder and executive director of the nonprofit Boulanger Initiative, which she started in 2018 with her colleague Joy Leilani Garbutt. The initiative champions the works of women composers through consulting, performance, education, and commissions. Welcome to the Viola Centric Podcast.
Thank you.
Laura, we're so excited to have you here.
I'm excited to be here.
It's really fun to have you sitting as concertmaster of National Philharmonic. That's been really a refreshing thing. And when you came to National Philharmonic, there's so many changes happening right now.
Yeah, sure. When I first moved here, I moved here to do the graduate string quartet residency at UMD. I subbed with Nat Phil infrequently when I had a chance, but I came in during COVID, which it's a very strange time to start a concertmaster position when there's totally. No audience and you have no idea what you're doing and you're curating concerts for video and like creating a TV show, which nobody knew how to do. So we were just like figuring it out as we went. And the weirdest part is not being able to like form relationships with the musicians, right? You couldn't be within 6 feet of anybody and you couldn't really socialize and try to get out of the room as soon as you can after rehearsal. And so now that we're actually back, it feels like this rebirth of Nat Phil. It feels like it's actually back, right? So we get to start playing regular concerts and have all the audience that was actually there last weekend. It's the first time in like 2 years that I've played for an audience of that size. Just such a relief. It's so different to have people there that you're playing for. It's so different when it's just in a bubble or a silo. You're playing for each other or for a camera or something. Just the energy is not the same. And so now that I'm actually getting to like meet the musicians and form relationships with people and even figure out what the quirks are of different sections and things like that. I mean, when you join an orchestra in this position, you sort of try to figure out what the personality of a section is or certain players or something like this. And it was impossible for the last 2 years. So I'm starting to finally form these ideas of what Nat Phil actually is. It's really nice.
That's so interesting to bring up because of course that's something that you do as a concertmaster, but I never thought of that as almost like you're figuring out the climate or the atmosphere of a workplace. Huh? You have to figure out what the personality of the different sections are and how is the best way to relate to them. How is the best way to give them direction that will be received well?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're almost like a project manager, almost. Figure out the best way to work with your colleagues and your sections based on the way that they, you know, interact.
Yeah. Well, and with different orchestras, I almost feel like, I don't know, I have multiple personalities or something because you just have a sense when you sit down with a group what the energy is and how to talk to them and reach people the best way. And Nat Phil, it's taken so much longer because of COVID. So it's really interesting to finally start to be able to figure out what the identity of Nat Phil is. Every orchestra is just completely different.
We all know the role of a concertmaster in terms of what it's traditionally there. You're representing all of the musicians of the orchestra. You're sort of that figurehead leadership position that translates messages directly to the conductor and is able to be listening and watching over what's going on. But we're getting into something, I think, a little bit deeper about that role. Is there anything specific that you think about that's your responsibility as concertmaster that goes beyond sort of those traditional kind of definitions?
I constantly think about leading the sound and how the sound fills the space and how to best have everybody think about it in the same way and imagine what the sound is doing above us or in the hall or something and not just our own sound. And really thinking about the group sound and what we want it to be, especially with a piece like La Mer, like we did this weekend, when it's all about colors and textures and all of this. And it's completely different from The Planets, where you're just like, okay, how much sound can I make? Completely opposite spectrum. This is the kind of concert where you're asked to do like everything in your wheelhouse. And with La Mer, it's so much about listening to the group sound and seeing where you fit in terms of colors and textures. And there's so much going on and in and outs, and being able to relate those ideas in the same way. It's sometimes you can tell that different sections are thinking about it in very different ways. And the best way to pull those together and try to have people thinking about the same thing, have the same goals, thinking about it as one organism and how to lead that organism and make it act as one whole instead of section and the section and the section and that section.
Mm-hmm. I can really honestly say that in many of the orchestras that I've played in, rarely does a concertmaster speak to the whole group about sound.
Mm.
The concertmaster seems like a very unused tool that the conductor has to be like, okay, can you explain to the orchestra how to make this sound that I want?
Yeah, a lot of times the conductor-concertmaster relationship determines how much the concertmaster gets to give input.
Yeah.
And Peter's so open and he's so gracious. And sometimes conductor personalities are not that way.
Right.
So you don't really have the option of giving input. But Peter's just completely open to feedback from anybody in the orchestra, not just me. But he's one of the least egotistical conductors I think I've ever worked with. It's a rare find.
Yeah, that's really true. That makes a lot of sense that that relationship between the two of you has to be open enough that you feel that flexibility. But I love the idea that that's a role that should be expanded into that way, you know, because I think conductors, obviously, at their core, they are really listening to that sound and trying to get their vision across. But I mean, how many times have we had this experience, no matter what orchestra where we're playing, and we can clearly hear things that are happening that need to be addressed that maybe aren't on the conductor's agenda, and to have somebody who's on the, you know, boots on the ground, so to speak, like, and what better representative than the concertmaster? It's just an interesting exploration of how that role could be expanded in more groups.
For sure. There's never enough rehearsal time. You can't ever get to everything.
True.
It's never going to be perfect. You're never going to have enough time to talk about everything you want to. And we're doing Mahler 5 later this season, the rescheduled one from the canceled January concert. And yes,
we'll be there.
I'm so excited to play the Adagietto and to get to work with just the strings. And I mean, again, it's so much about color and moving as an organism and thinking the same. The Lucerne Festival Orchestra has a recording, a YouTube video of Mahler 5 that I've been obsessed with for a very long time. And one of my favorite things about it is that if you mute the video and you watch them, the way that it moves, it looks like they're like underwater in the ocean or something. The way that it ebbs and flows, and even the amount of bow, sometimes they just use like a centimeter. And I'm so obsessed with that video. I watch it all the time. It's so inspiring to me. It's a completely unusual orchestra because they're mostly chamber musicians in there, like from different string quartets. It's like a summer festival kind of thing, or they pull winds and brass from different orchestras. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the all-stars of orchestras putting all of them together, and they actually play chamber music together. And it makes me so happy to see an orchestra do that, because it's so rare.
Yeah,
so many times that instrumentalists just sit in their chair and they follow the stick and that's it. But to actually like use every single crevice and ion of your being to be completely present and in the moment and really aware of everything that's going on and try to work in that way. It's always the goal for me.
I would love to be that kind of player. I feel like it just gets kind of beat out of you in America.
Yeah.
Yep.
In Europe, it's much more commonplace to move like Berlin.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And if you're lucky enough, I feel like I've made a point to consistently have chamber music as part of my regular gig life. Mm-hmm. You get to exercise those muscles, But to your point, Steph, I mean, yes, I literally had the movement in my playing directed out of me in orchestra as a young person. And so you have to switch gears. But this is great because, of course, Laura, would you consider yourself a chamber musician who plays in orchestras?
Yes. First and foremost, chamber musician, always. Yep.
So that will dictate the way you lead an orchestra, which is awesome to think about.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's a completely different philosophy than a lot of American orchestras. And you're right, it's beat out of us. I mean, there's so many orchestras that I've sat in where they actually tell you not to move.
Don't move. Yeah. Only the principals.
Yeah.
Only the principals.
Like, if you move too much, they won't hire you back. Mm-hmm. Crazy. Crazy.
Or you won't get tenure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What a wild thing. So to have a leader of an orchestra encourage you to do the opposite of that is pretty exciting.
Now that I know, I'm going to say Laura Colgate told me that when I play with this group, it is okay. It's A-okay to move around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's A-okay and encouraged.
And encouraged. And especially when we play the Mahler Adagietto, we'll have to be like extra. We're going to watch that video. It's like insider research into Laura's head.
We should have like a big film night where we just have everybody in and do a screening.
Viewing party.
A watch party. Love it. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Cocktails, Mahler.
Yes. Shifting into chamber music, you are also cultivating a chamber music series through National Philharmonic, right?
Yeah. I'm curating and I'm just finishing next season, the 22-23 season right now, and putting together the very final pieces to have the creative freedom to really put together something that is truly unique. And my vision is so much fun. And to do it for musicians that I know, you know how they play, you know what they like to play. And I'm going to guess that most of the programs that I curate, people have not played 90% of the repertoire that I put on programs. So it's always sort of an exercise in expanding and exploring new repertoire and new composers and all of this. But being able to not have to do the traditional and to be able to really mix it up and get super creative. I don't want to give anything away for next season.
No, don't do that. No spoilers.
But I mean, it started with the videos from the pandemic year.
Beautifully done. Really beautifully done. Love those.
It was to think about the difference between curating for an in-person audience and something on screen. The first thing that always entered my mind was our attention span and how short it is. And if I actually just put a 45-minute string quartet on there and called it a day, people would tune in for a hot 6 minutes and be like, all right, that was beautiful. I'm done. What's next? I've heard it a million times.
Yep.
So having to fit in the script and hold people's attention and everything from props to switching up instrumentation as much as possible within the program and all of that really forced me to think out of the box and basically just learn a completely new skill. And I think a lot of that, you know, I'm trying to carry over into the in-person scenario and see how we can stay out of the box in person. And it's completely different exercise.
That's cool. Let me ask you, though, you found a lot of success curating these kind of sampler programs for a video audience. And a lot of people tuned into those. And those people were not captive audiences, right? They didn't buy a ticket and they weren't there for an entire 2-hour program. What from that model do you think we can bring into the concert hall that might bring more people to an actual physical concert who may have watched something on video, but maybe like, well, I don't know if I want to commit 2.5 hours of my Sunday to coming into a concert hall?
I mean, so much of it is the social aspect now. And you think about what sets the classical tradition.
I know, we've had that conversation.
Apart.
That was an air quotes reference, guys.
I hate that word. I'm so sick of it.
We're with you.
It has nothing to do with what we do. But you watch the audience just so still. And if somebody makes one peep of sound, everybody's like, who was that? Why is somebody taking a cough drop out of a wrapper in the middle of this piece. I'm horrified. Or, like, why is somebody looking at their phone? Or how could you possibly take a sip at a moment like this? Think about any other tradition. Like, you go to any other concert that's not, again, air quotes, classical tradition and setting and audience. And there's none of that stuffiness and the expectation of being a statue for 2 hours and all of these ridiculous things. First of all, expanding the audience, making sure that the community, the actual community, is represented in the room in every way, not just on stage, but in the audience, the music that's being played, comprehensively, that the community and the diversity of the community that we live in is actually on display. But then taking that tradition of not having the freedom to clap in the middle of something or show appreciation or enjoy something by moving. There's so many times where I'm in a concert and I just, like, I can't help myself. I get carried away and move in my chair.
Right.
Totally.
I mean, you judge yourself for that because you think that the people around you are going to be like, this person needs to stop moving.
Yeah.
But really, do they? No. It's the other way around. We've got to infect the statues.
Yes, totally. By moving ourselves. And yes, once people see that it's okay, but the musicians on stage are moving, then of course they can express their enjoyment by moving.
I mean, there's so many ways. Taking performers off of the stage, making a completely different setup, whether it's the audience is surrounding the musicians on the floor or we bring some audience people on stage. That changes the energy in the room completely, immediately. Pulling technology into it, it's fine. Pull your phone out. We put our programs on our phones. And I know Tanglewood does this. They have an app where you can go and read real-time notes about what's going on in the concert and find out about the program and chat and ask questions about it and all of this. Then not having a paper program, speaking from the stage, having technology, what other industry does not have
Amen, sister.
At a concert? It's crazy. It doesn't exist. Doesn't exist.
Yeah, there's so much of it. With 9th Street, we switched to QR codes for our programs. Mm-hmm. And for the first concert, we printed out 5 or something, maybe for, you know, an older audience member who doesn't have a smartphone. But yeah, it's fine. And it made me so happy and Nat Phil that we stole this for 9th Street. People can post, take video of us and post a story. It's fine. It's good.
Yes.
It's exposure.
Yes.
Do we care if someone's taking a story of us while we're playing? No, I don't. You know, I mean, it should be encouraged. That's a good thing. Yeah. I totally agree. I think this is great. And it's exciting to think about backing up to the planning process when you're choosing repertoire, when you're cultivating the feel of a program. Mm. Do you have baseline values, or you mentioned a vision? So I'm just wondering if there are general things that guide your decision making and then, you know, how you go about sourcing music for that. What goes into that process for you? Because that's very interesting to me. I think planning programs is a challenge.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Especially non-traditional.
Right.
How long does it take to put together a Brahms piano quintet? All of the things that we've always done. And there's no challenge to that anymore. It's old news, but just the amount of research that goes into finding new repertoire and challenging repertoire, something that challenges the musicians and the audience and expanding the way that we think. And I'll use the word diversity, but I mean in every sense of the word. So including music from Gregorian chant all the way up to living composers on the same program, and being able to find threads across so many different boundaries and lines, things that relate to one another and tie us together, and finding that in different ways in programs is what I find really interesting. Sometimes it'll start with, this is one of my favorite chamber pieces and I really just want to be able to program it. So I figure out what should go with that piece. But so many times it's thematic, if it's a composer's anniversary, but how to make it intriguing and captivate the audience and make it fun for the musicians to learn this new repertoire. Because again, stuff that we just haven't learned. We haven't been forced or even encouraged
right.
by schools or by organizations, arts presenters, to ever have to go outside the wheelhouse of the traditional canon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's so interesting because the more you go down this road, the more you realize how much it makes sense and how much more varied and rich the experience becomes for musicians and for listeners and for audience members, that there are all these different ways you can go and that there's something to represent everybody.
Mm-hmm. And there are so many voices to be heard.
Yes.
I think when you were doing your doctorate, is that when you did the other half?
The other half of humanity has something to say.
Yep. Yes, has something to say. And it's so true because music is the backbone of revolution. It's the way that artists express their time on this earth, their struggles, their victories. And we're just not even hearing from a lot of that. It's part of our history.
Well, and it's the way that we build community and reach each other and reach our humanity in the most profound way is through music. And to not connect everybody through that, to only connect a certain portion or a demographic through music, mm-hmm. works against humanity.
So what set you on this path to be so interested in exploring this?
We keep saying encouraged, allowed. We weren't even allowed to play stuff that wasn't by Bach or Beethoven or Mozart, right?
You're right. Not when I was in school.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about the pandemic is that it forced the classical music industry to finally start entering the 21st century. We're not quite there yet, but...
at least working
right.
on it.
at least it's like started on that path. Whereas there wasn't even a hint of it before the pandemic. And now it's everybody has grown antennas. And this awareness has expanded across the industry in a way that without the pandemic, it would have taken so much longer to get to where we've come from even a year and a half ago. The shift in consciousness and what our goals as artists have to be. Hmm. For me, I was at UMD Excelsa Quartet, and it was an all-female string quartet. We were all getting doctorates at UMD during the residency. We realized at some point that there had never been an all-female quartet with doctors before, that if we graduated together,
wow.
we would be the first one, which is crazy to think about.
That is very crazy to think about.
And we had toyed with different ways to do sort of combined thesis ideas and using gender equity as a part of that. I had always wanted to focus on women composers and repertoire by women composers for my thesis. And then just after I finished my coursework, we were in residence at the Smithsonian. One morning, there was just this tiny click in my neck, this tiny little pop. And within minutes, I was just in excruciating pain and I couldn't move. Mm. And it turned out that I had two herniated discs in my cervical spine.
In your neck?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I have never heard of that. I've only heard of it down in the lumbar area, particularly.
Well, and what I found out is that the lower two levels on the cervical spine are actually called the violin levels.
Oh.
Because of this, that motion of raising your shoulder and having to clamped down on the violin. And I didn't know that it was a thing, but I found violinist after violinist after violinist in the industry that it had the same thing.
Wow.
So I couldn't play, I couldn't drive, I couldn't function for months. That was the end of the quartet. We were in search of a new violinist while that happened. So two members in a quartet does not work.
Yeah.
So that was the end of Excelsa Quartet. And I did a ton of research and found the newest medical technology. I had spinal surgery and I'm great now, obviously.
Good.
I moved to Hawaii indefinitely. I moved in with one of my best friends
wow.
who lives on Kauai. And she said, this is the best place in the world to heal. Come live with me until you're better.
Was it the best place to heal?
It was absolutely the best place to heal. And I mean, I didn't even take a violin. I couldn't play. I didn't really know if I'd play again.
Wow.
By the time I had surgery, I was so atrophied that it took me months and months just to be able to have a strong enough neck to do normal things. But during that time when I couldn't play, I wasn't just not going to get my doctorate after 3 years of coursework. So I figured if I can't play, I'll just do a written dissertation instead of a performance-based dissertation. And I started doing as much research as I could on women composers and repertoire. And the deeper I went into it, the more horrified I was that I had never been exposed to this music before. In Hawaii, I actually had a part-time job at a bikini shop. Never thought that would be something that happened in my life. But I would be in there without anybody else on staff, and I would start like blasting Pamela Z or Sari Aho from the store speakers, and people would come in, or my boss would walk in and be like, "What do you think you're doing right now? Can you put Jack Johnson back on, please?"
That's the typical bikini shop Hawaii music. Yeah, Jack Johnson.
Yep.
Oh, it's got to be Jack Johnson.
No one better. Oh.
Yes. I would sit there and just listen to anything I could find, read everything I could find, and a lot of research on why it was a problem, historical issues around it, and why it just, the needle hadn't moved, right? It wasn't getting better. Nobody was doing anything about it. So the further I dove into the idea of gender equity in music as a whole, the more I wasn't really an option after a while. I had to do something. Nobody was doing anything. And I just felt completely compelled that I didn't really have the choice. I had to do something. And then when I was back, Tacoma Bevco up here.
Love that place.
It's like a Friday night. I was sitting there on my computer with my noise cancelers on, working on my dissertation. And Dave Miller from Barclay yes. Brass came over and...
We know Dave.
And tapped me on the shoulder. I was like, "Dave, I'm trying to write my dissertation." He's like, "Why are you in a coffee shop on a Friday night? Then? Go home." He was like, "There's somebody here that you have to meet. You absolutely..." I was like, "Okay, give me a few minutes. I'm trying to focus." So I went over, and it was Joy Leilani Garbett. We had never met before, but she was like, "I'm also doing a dissertation on women composers right now." She's an organist, and the first time we met up again at Tacoma Beverage Co. Thank you, Seth.
I bet. I would be too if I lived
yeah,
there.
Thanks, Seth. Thanks. Exactly.
Thanks. It's like my second home.
Sidebar, this is a coffee shop who's owned by a really fantastic tuba player in the area.
Support musicians.
That, totally. Yes.
I mean, they also have excellent food and alcoholic beverages. I'm like a walking advertisement for them on a regular basis.
Sponsored by Tacoma Beverage. Yeah,
you're welcome,
Use
Seth.
Use code VealCentric. An email out to you, Seth.
I've got him on speed dial. I'll let him know.
We'll have to talk to him about that.
But after that first meeting, it started with, okay, well, we have to do a concert series. And then I think within 2 weeks, we were like, all right, there's no hub. There's so many great grassroots organizations or individuals doing things, but there's no overseeing organization trying to tie all of these things together and thinking about the long term, what are the best ways to solve gender equity and get women's music out there, and really focusing on the bigger picture of what do we have to do in the industry and how do we solve this problem. So I think most of what BI has done over the past 3 years has very much been out of the public view. It's been building resources and a database and a lot of planning programs and different resources that we can give to the community to make it as easy as possible for people, whether it's a musician or a curator, presenter, an orchestra, a radio station, anything. It's a very exciting time.
So you're developing all these resources to promote gender equity. What are the other steps that you see that need to happen in order to bring it on to a more level playing field as far as programming?
I think group one orchestras have to take more responsibility. I think that excerpt lists need to be updated. It takes time. It takes a lot of conversation. It requires so many different things to happen just to change one excerpt, one list for one instrument.
Totally.
But it has to be done, and something we're working on. We've actually just done the soft launch of our Redefining the Canon program, which is on our website, and we are bringing on orchestral partners, and excerpt foragers go through parts and scores that we send them to forage out excerpts that can be used for auditions.
Wait, they're excerpt, what are they called?
Foragers. Mushroom foragers.
Stop.
Yes, like a mushroom forager.
So do you need like a
That's what I thought.
It's like a human, like there, you know, pigs that sniff out truffles or whatever.
Essentially.
You need like a human that has a special skill set that they're like, I sense that there's an excerpt exactly in this Lawrence Price symphony.
It's so complicated to get anything for a large budget orchestra, like yes. Philly, New York, San Francisco.
Sure, sure.
The number of steps that you have to go through. The musicians committee, the board, the admin, the number of things that have to be done.
For an excerpt.
Yeah.
That's blowing my mind right now.
Well, and really every orchestra is different mm-hmm. in what their CBA says and how they're allowed to change things and the steps that they have to take to actually go through that whole thing.
At its root, it is asking them to consider some existential things about the way they run their organizations, too. Like what the reason is for having the excerpt list that they have and why they're not willing to consider changing that excerpt list. What does it mean about the shift in criteria of accepting candidates who audition on their list if the excerpts have changed to be more inclusive? And there's a lot of questions that I think would need to be addressed as they make those decisions, and they have to be willing to consider that the entire process would shift as a result. It's a
big can of worms, yeah.
Think about how well you knew the standard excerpt list. By the time we're freshmen in conservatory or higher education, yep. mm-hmm. we know them back and forth. In our sleep, we can play most yep. of these excerpts. And to start having younger people entering the industry learning these new pieces to that level, how quickly that would change the industry. Mm.
Yes. I will say, as somebody who is responsible, 25% responsible for programming a chamber music concert series throughout the year, to have a resource to go to find music by female and non-binary composers is huge, huge. Because otherwise you are just...
Well,
searching around. And so doing all that back end right. work, I think it's really wonderful. And it's exciting to think about what you guys are going to do in the future.
Well, it takes so much energy and time and effort to do this kind of work and research for every individual. Teachers don't have the time to do it. They're already completely overworked. It should not be on them. Mm-hmm. A lot of times students don't even have the time. Certainly administrators and presenters don't. So we have a prototype of our database now. It has over 7,000 works in it by women. And we're coming at it from every angle. So how can it be the most helpful for orchestras, for radio stations? What do all of these entities need to be able to program things the easiest? Mm-hmm. And putting all of those variables into it. So the database will be public, freely accessible before too long. And we have our consulting service, which I think is probably right now the best resource for the industry, and anybody can use it. It's on a sliding scale, very affordable. And if you can't afford it, we'll still work with you. We'll figure something out.
Yeah.
We do a lot of in-kind work with people. There's so much to be done that there's always a way. You can go and fill out the form on our website. National Phil was, I think, our first orchestra that used the consulting service. And Peter Gajewski, for those listening, the conductor, mm-hmm. went and filled it out, and he needed specifically a piece that was like 7 to 8 minutes by a non-living Black composer, preferably American, very specific instrumentation, exact what he had for that concert and what else was on the program so that it would go well. And our research team just goes and finds as many possibilities. If we give you 10 and you're like, I don't like any of these, then we go and find more.
What?
But we always make sure that the parts are available and in good condition. That's one of the biggest problems, especially for orchestras, that if you want there to be a recording available of some sort, we make sure if you are doing this specifically to make the very first recording of something, then we'll find something that there isn't. So it's really like anything that anybody's looking for. And it's the hardest work.
Yes.
To be able to offer that to the industry, the public, is a game changer.
That is incredible.
And where can people find that form?
It's on our website under services, so BoulangerieInitiative.org, if you go under services.
Great. So if you're planning a recital, if you want to pass the information on to your music director or whoever is programming whatever it is that you're going to be doing, that's a great resource.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's incredible. Thank you for telling us about that, because I can already think of at least two different ways that I would utilize that resource in my own work. That's so cool. So we noticed that
as of this past year, you started a position with the University of Maryland as an adjunct professor of...
The official title is Financial Entrepreneurship for Arts Leaders, but it's very deceptive because it's like Entrepreneurship 101. It's just like diving in with both feet. I mean, yes, there's a lot of finance in there, but it's really, it's comprehensive of everything entrepreneurial. So it's all of the arts and humanities, undergrads and grad students. So it's not just music students. Oh. It was journalist and computer science.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Theater, dance, everything. So that changes the way that I thought about how to form the syllabus. As soon as I was offered the opportunity, the first thing I thought was they should be ready to launch a project at the end of the semester. And starting with that idea, moving backwards to, okay, what do you have to learn in one semester to be able to be prepared to do that? So they went through everything from marketing, building trailer videos, building a website, coming up with, essentially they were all ready to launch a company or a project by the end. And their final project was pitching their idea. And it was, obviously it was just the students who were their audience, but we could be investors. It could be whatever audience they chose, whatever they needed to pitch to. But just to be able to pitch something for like a sophomore, there's a lot that goes into that.
Do musicians sign up for the class?
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. There was, say, maybe 20% of the class, maybe a little bit more even. It was a good number. And their ideas were so good for their projects. And I mean, there's a number of them who are launching these things now. They had their budgets built and their websites ready to go and trailer videos and a business plan, everything. So it's going to be really exciting to see who does what.
I wish there had been that kind of training
when
I was in school.
Same.
Absolutely.
It should be.
Same. It should be required. And it shouldn't just be one semester. I mean, every topic that I covered should be its own class. How are we not taught how to do taxes?
Yeah.
Or build a budget?
Or even have a website. You need to have a website. Even if you're freelance or you're a teacher, whatever, you need to have a website these days. You have to have presence.
Seriously.
I just love the idea that just by attending a semester of a class like that, a musician who goes into school, it plants a seed in their head that says, oh, wait a second, maybe I have something individual that I can say out there, or there's something that really speaks to me authentically that I can take and build on, and that carves my path. It just totally shifts the perspective from one of going out there and chasing down the opportunities that are for whoever manages to grab them versus you're carving your own way from the start. It's just very cool.
Yeah, it's a shift in mindset in that it's instead of someone giving me this opportunity, I'm going to go out there and get that opportunity. I'm going to create that opportunity. You're not waiting for someone to select you for an orchestral job. It's important that you take all this into consideration and you make yourself the best product available that you can. But that just takes everything out of your hands. Whereas classes like this put everything in your hands and you can go ahead and create whatever it is your vision is.
It's so related to the idea of just when we were in school, it's a little better now, but we were just taught to play whatever music was put in front of us and accept the path that had always been musicians.
Totally.
Straight from youth symphony to conservatory to orchestral auditions and never sort of creating anything yourself, just following that path that had always been followed by your teachers and the like awakening of our industry in a way in terms of the repertoire we're playing or the paths that we can create on our own. It's all just this level of awareness and consciousness that seems to, we're coming out of like some kind of a coma in this industry. And we've never been pushed to do anything different. Again, we've been discouraged to do anything different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's past time that this happened. There's so much hope in that. And it's such an exciting time to actually see change starting to happen in the music industry.
Absolutely. To your point about what we were encouraged or discouraged from doing, and that the idea was you go out and you take auditions and you're trained to take auditions. What ends up happening too is that then your whole
version for yourself of success is success in auditions. And the truth is, no matter how great of a player you are, the vast majority of musicians are not going to win auditions because there aren't enough of them. So to understand that there's more you can offer and that it can come from what Stephanie said, what can you offer the world versus what is the world going to offer you? And just shifting that mindset, the more we can encourage that in young people, the better off we'll be. But I think it's so important for people our age to know that that's true too, you know?
It's not too late.
Yeah, you can shift that mentality. I feel like we're on a good track.
There's growing pains.
I mean, we feel it every day. There's so much to be done. Don't even get me started about auditions and the audition process.
I know. Oh my God.
Oh, we might have to have you back on. You can't just drop that and then we can't talk about it.
Well, how much do you learn from an audition that you actually need to know? Put somebody in an orchestra.
100%.
I have to give you a shout out again for having the Boulanger Initiative poster on your wall.
Heck yes. And they just came out. Laura, I'll let you explain it with an accompaniment book, which I'm so excited to have.
Yeah. Well, we have two different alphabet women composers posters. And we just released our companion booklet. So every composer that's on the poster has their own little design, their graphic, beautifully drawn by Chelsea Hill. And there's information on each composer. And then there's a playlist, a code in the booklet. And you can go in and listen to all of their music.
It's awesome. The fact that that exists and then your students can be in your studio and just pull up the code and then it's on their phone. And they take it out with them, and they go and listen, and they get inspired, and it's just so cool. Such a cool, cool idea.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Laura. Thank you so much for listening today, and thanks also to our Season 2 sponsors, Arcrest and Potter Violin.
Another thanks to Alto Clef Gifts, where you can purchase viola-centric shirts and mugs and a variety of other fun items featuring our beloved Alto Clef.
The viola-centric theme music was written and produced by JP Wogeman and is performed by Steph and myself. You can support our future episodes by supporting our sponsors through our PayPal link or Venmo and by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. And please consider sharing your favorite episodes with your music-loving friends.
Thanks again for listening. Let's talk soon.